And we're holding on page 42 in Shabbos Oislamed. The Perek is talking about, again, various kinds of equipment and decorations and whatnot that an animal that you are and aren't allowed to have your animal go out with on Shabbos. So one of them, the Mishnah mentions, is that you may have, that the animals have large udders, which are going to scrape on the ground or on thorns or whatever. So you may want to tie a piece of cloth around them to keep them from getting scratched up. So that you're allowed to do. But on the other hand, for example, if you're just doing it because you don't want the milk to go to waste and you're going to tie it on like that, then that would be also because that's not for the needs of the animal and because it may fall off, etc. So in that connection, the Gemara mentions that there was one place where they had goats that had extra large udders and they needed this kind of treatment. So now that leads the Gemara now to digress to talk about another example of an unusual situation involving breasts. So the Gemara says, turn it up on. There was once a man whose wife passed away. She left him over a child that needed to be nursed. But he couldn't afford to hire a wet nurse. So who's going to feed the baby? They didn't have formula in those days. So a nest happened to him. His breasts opened up like the breasts of a woman. A man, after all, has those body parts. They just don't usually produce milk. But in this case, they did. And he nursed his son. So Rabbi Yosef says, come see how great this person was, what a tzaddik he was, that a nest like that happened to him. But on the other hand, Abaya counters, he says, how lowly and unimportant in Hashem's eyes, so to speak, is this person. On the contrary, that Maisa Bereshis were changed for him. In other words, that Hashem could have accomplished the same thing in another way without making that kind of mess for him. Rashi explains that he wasn't zoicha to have the gates of schar open for him like this. Hashem could have made instead that he's going to be able to have a parnasa. So then he can hire a wet nurse like this. Instead, Hashem made this kind of nest. So Abaya is saying it shows that. So Marashah explains, obviously he had some kind of nest. He obviously had some kind of schus, otherwise the nest wouldn't have happened at all. But this would be the kind of nest where it's deducted from his schus. So that's why Abaya is saying that it shows that if Hashem really wanted to do the best possible nest for him, he would have done it in a way that it doesn't deduct anything from his schus. Marshall also points out, by the way, that it's not an example of Ein Kol Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh, because again, a man has those parts, they just don't normally function as far as producing milk, so it's not really Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. There's various other explanations that Mefoshim have of what Abaye is countering to Rabbi Yosef. On the side of here, it brings from Goin Yaakov, brings from a couple of Sfarim, that the vote is that similar to what Marsha is saying about taking away from his zchusim, that Rabbi Yosef is saying that he had obviously a tremendous zchus to have a nest like that. And Abaya says that true, he is an Odom Godol, certainly, but now that Menachem Lo Mischa Yosef, now he's going to wind up Gorua, he's going to wind up on a lowlier state than he was before. And in fact, the fact that it was such a great nest means that the amount deducted from his account in Shemayim is going to be so much greater. Ben Yehoyada has another explanation on it also. He says, sometimes what you have is a person, sometimes you have at a particular time, a tzaddik is davening for something, and meanwhile you have somebody else is also davening for the same thing for himself, and Hashem answers the regular person, maybe he himself wouldn't have enough schusim, but once Hashem is answering the tzaddik, then so to speak, the other person gets brought in as well. So had it been that Hashem provided him parnasa, then you could say that it means that Hashem answered him in the schus of some other tzaddik, not necessarily that he himself has great schusim. Here, on the other hand, this kind of thing, obviously nobody else is davening for. Therefore, on the one hand, it means Hashem answered his tefillah individually. On the other hand, the fact is, if it was that great, Hashem could have instead answered him in a way that would also help other people as well. We're like this, it only benefits him. And therefore, in that sense, Abaya is saying it means that means he's not really very good. So the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Nachman, Teda, you could see the difference between these different kinds of nisim. The misrachish nisa v'lo ivru mezoni. We see that there can happen a nes min hashamayim that people are saved in various ways that involve nisim v'lo ivru mezoni. Yet you don't find the nest that there should be mezonis created for the tzaddikim. For example, Rashi says that they should find in their granary that grain grows over there, So you don't really have that. That would already be an example, Marsha says, of Ein Kol Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. Even that, you do have rare examples. For example, you have a story in Masechta Tainis with Abba Elazar Ish Bar Tosa, where you have a story over there where he had one package of wheat, which was all that he bought for his daughter's upcoming wedding because for her Nadin, because he had given away all the rest of his money to tzedakah. And the upshot was that he found a silo full of grain. So it happens, but it's much rarer. So Rav Nachman saying, you see that, so to speak, it's harder for Hashem. Oh, sorry, I skipped a line over here. Rabbi Yehuda, Bo Yireh Kama Koshim Mizonosu Shel Adam. Come see how, so to speak, difficult it is for Hashem to create mizonos for a person. Shenishtanu Olav Sidrei Bereishis, that Hashem would, so to speak, prefer to change the natural order to make that he as a man should be able to produce milk rather than there should be panosa. And that's what Rav Nachman says. Teda, you can see, so to speak, how difficult it is for Hashem. Demisruchish Nisav Olav Ivru Mizoni, that you see that nisim happen, but mizonos are not created. So to speak, that's more difficult for Hashem to do. Since we're talking about a man where something unusual happened with his body, so the Gemara further digresses to talk about something else, an unusual thing involving a man and his wife. By the way, Eitz Yosef points out there's a medrash that says that the same thing happened with Mordechai, that Esther, we know, her father passed away before she was born, her mother passed away in childbirth, and Mordechai raised her. And there's a medrash that says that he also, one time, didn't have a wet nurse available, and he was able to nurse her. So what happens over here? Abaye is saying, Kama Geruazeh, he wouldn't say that about Mordechai. So Eitz Yosef brings the answer, actually, Tosfos Yishonim in the Gemara brings it, that the difference is that this person couldn't afford a wet nurse. So we would have expected the nest that Hashem could have done for him would have been to create that he should have panasa where he didn't before. In Mordechai's case, he had the money. He just couldn't find anybody available. There was no wet nurse available. So of necessity, Hashem had to make the nest for him. Okay, so the Gemara continues. Tanabon, Maisa ba'odam echad shenasa isha gidemes. It happened once that a certain man married a woman whose hand had been amputated. V'lahiku ba'ad yoy moisa. He didn't realize it until she passed away. Throughout all their years of married life, he never realized that she's missing a hand. Amar Rav Yosef. So here also we have a similar kind of thing where Rav Yosef versus Rav Chia. There it was Rav Yosef and Abaya are arguing about the person. Was he a great person? Was he not such a great person? Here you have a similar kind of argument. Amar Rav Yosef. Boy or Rebbe, it says on the bottom, Boy or Rebbe, come tsnua ishazu. Come see how tsniastic this woman was, Shalehikuba Baila, that her husband, throughout all those years, never realized that she's missing a hand. She obviously must have kept herself very wrapped up in a very tsniastic way. Amalei Rav Chia, but Rav Chia said to him, Zu dauka makach. For a woman, it's normal to do that. After all, any woman usually covers herself, all the more so over here, she had every reason to, because otherwise her husband would find out. Ella, rather, what you should say is Kamat Sanua Adam Zeh, how tzniastic was this man, Shalahiku Be'ishtoi, that all those years he never realized, he never looked unnecessarily at his wife, and therefore he never realized that she's missing a body part. There is, in fact, an interesting analysis from Moshe Feinstein on this in his Sefer Dibris Moshe, where he discusses the one point he discusses over there is this kind of thing where a man is Makadish a woman and then discovers later on that she's missing a body part could be grounds for Mekachtos. You could say that the Kiddushin are not Kiddushin at all. So that can be part of the argument over here between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Chia is whether she was doing right by this in hiding this from him, or should she have in fact have informed him so that this way he could decide whether he wants to stay married to her or not. So then Rav Chia is saying that the fact that he didn't realize it means, in other words, that therefore there's nothing to worry about that she didn't show him. It shows that he himself, he wouldn't have considered it a mekachtos even if he had known about it. Okay. The Mishnah goes on to talk about, again, different other kinds of things that animals are you're allowed to have your animal go out with on Shabbos. One of them is the Mishnah says, Horechelim yotzis kvulos. Ewes, female sheep, you're allowed to take them out on Shabbos, kvulos. So the Gemara says, my kvulos, what does that phrase, what does that word kvulos mean? It means shemachablim al yishalahem lamata, means they tie, the word kvul, means a bond, means like a chain or a rope or something. So they would tie their tail downward to cover their private parts. Because at this particular time, you don't want the males to mate with them. So therefore, you keep their tails tied down so it's not possible for them to. So the Gemara says, "My mashma dahai kovul lishna deloy ovid perihu." Well, fine. So we know that the word kovul means a binding. But after all, you could also equally well have, Mefarshim explained, the point of the Gemara's question is, you could equally well have that you bind the tail upward because you do want the males to mate with them. And in fact, the Mishnah mentions that kind of thing as well. So how do you know, what makes us say that koval specifically means not only tying, but also lishna dele ovid peirigu? It's an expression of not producing peiris. That, therefore, that justifies saying that kvolos means tying the tail downward. So dichtiv, you have a pasuk in Melachim. The pasuk describes how we know that Shlomo and Chiram Melech Tzur had an alliance. Chiram supplied wood and stones and craftsmen to build the Beis Hamikdash. In return, Shlomo supplied to Chiram lots of food because Chiram's territory was mainly the island of Tzur. In those days, it was an island. Later on, it became connected to the mainland. But they didn't have a lot of agricultural land. They had some on the mainland, but not very much. So therefore, Shlomo was supplying lots of food to them from Eretz Yisrael, and in return, Chiram was supplying him with wood and stones and whatnot. So the pasuk describes at one point Shlomo designated 20 cities that he gave to Chiram for this purpose. Now, Mefarshim on the pasuk explained, doesn't mean he gave them to them him outright. So they can't give away parts of Eretz Yisrael. It means basically that he designated those cities are going to be where the wheat and the oil and whatnot are produced that are going to be to fulfill Shlomo's end of the deal. So the pasuk describes that Chiram went to check out the cities and he didn't like them. And he says, Maha orim elash and asata li ochi, what are these cities that you gave me, my brother? So he's calling Shlomo my brother as a token of friendship. In other words, these don't suit the purpose. And these cities were called the land of Kovul until this day. So my Eretz Kovul, so why did he call it the land of Kovul? Omer Avuna. Now the point is, in other words, that the point is that it wasn't producing what Chiram needed. But why exactly did he call it Kovul? So Amar Rav Huna, Shahoyu Babnei Adam, Sham Chubalin B'Kesef Abizah. Because the people who lived in those cities were tied down with silver and gold. In other words, they were very rich. So Rava says, in that case, if that was the problem, so what's the problem if the people there are rich? The previous pasuk says, Vala Yoshu. The cities were not good in Chiram's eyes. What's the problem? The people there are very rich. Therefore, Chiram didn't like the cities. What's the logic? And Rav Huna tells him, yes. The problem is, Chiram figured, since these people are very rich, and they're very pampered, they're not going to do work. And the whole point was that these cities are supposed to be the places where they're going to produce the wheat and the oil and so forth that Shlomo is supposed to supply to Chiram. If the people are very rich and very indolent and very pampered, they're not going to want to do that. So therefore, it defeats the purpose. So that's one meaning of kovul. But Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar, and here's where it comes in to what we said before about kovul, about not producing peiros. So Rav Nachman Yitzchok explains, Eretz Chumtin Hoysa. It was a land where the soil was very salty. We had a little while ago, we had about the Kav Chumtin, where the moshel about learning Torah and having to have Yiras Shemaim as well. Where, like when you store away grain, you have to store away within a certain amount of chumtin soil, which is salty, and so it helps preserve the grain. So here it was the same kind of thing. It was this very salty, and Rashi describes that it was cracked open. So it was that kind of land. It was like a swampy. It was like a swampy, salty area. So therefore, Chiram is complaining. That's not going to do. That's not going to do for growing the kind of crops that we need. Am I kovul? So why do they call it kovul? Dimistargabakara ad kavla, because the foot, when you try to walk in it, your foot sinks in until the kavla. Rashi explains that kavla means the ankle. Tosfos says it means the lower leg, the shirt. In any case, the point is it's like a very swampy, quicksandy or whatever area. The Amri Inchi, so people call it Ara Machabla. It's a land that's Machabla, which is the same Shurdish as Kobol, Dole Ovid Peri, which doesn't produce produce, and therefore that's what Chiram was complaining about, that won't suit the purpose that you're giving me these cities for me to collect the wheat and the oil and whatnot from. Anyway, the point is that we see that Kobol means not producing Peris, and we see that therefore Chiram actually called the place Eretz Kobol. Well, the end of it was, so in Divrei Hayomim, actually, it mentions cities that Chiron gave Shloim. So some of the Mephoshim explain over there that it means, in other words, you know, each part in Melachim versus in Divrei Hayomim, it's telling half the story. In Melachim, it says that Shloim gave him the cities. In Divrei Hayomim, it's saying that Chiron realized they're not fit for purpose, so he returned them to Shloim. And the upshot is the Sukkim go on to say that they still continued to have good relations between them. They made it, evidently they made other arrangements. So Pisgah, another quotation from the Mishnah, among the ways you're not allowed to have animals go out with on Shabbos is loy okud v'loy rogu. You're not allowed to have animals walk out to walk your animals walk outside on Shabbos in Rosh Hashanah. Okud or rogu. The point is, the Gemara explains at the beginning of the Perek that you can't have an animal go out with equipment on it that's more than what you need to guard this kind of animal and prevent it from running away or going wild. This okud and rogul is more than you would need for any animal, so therefore it's considered a burden on the that you're having the animal carry on traps. So what is okud? Amud of Yehuda, okud means akedas yad v'rego ki Yitzchak ben Avraham. The word okud means tie hand and foot together, like the way Yitzchak was bound by the akedah. Now, to be exact, actually, Marsha explains that by the animals over here, we're talking about tying one front leg and one back leg together. You're not tying both front legs. You're not tying one front leg to the back leg and the other front leg to the other back legs, and the animal won't be able to walk. With Yitzchak, they did. Yavram bound him up, both hands to both feet. But Marsha says, Bechlau, where do we see that Yitzchok was bound like that? How do we know it wasn't his hands together and his feet together? How do we know it was one hand to one foot? So other Mephoshim answered, because that way, like, the body is stretched out more and the neck is more available. The whole point was he's going to shecht Yitzchok, or so he thought. So therefore, it makes sense that they would have done it that way. But anyway, Marsha says that really the proof is just to show that the word okud means tie. So in the case of the animals, it means you tie one front leg to one back leg. And that way, the point is, the animal is kind of hobbled, and that way it can't run away. Rogul, when it's, we're saying you can't take out an animal on Shabbos, rogul, that means shalai yokuf yode or gabi zroye v'yikshar. That would mean to bend the lower leg of the animal to up against the middle part of the leg and then tie it. An animal's a kosher animal has three segments in its legs, and some non-kosher animals, all the animals that have hooves, including, for example, camels, have three segments in their legs. Also horses, for example, lots of others. They correspond basically to the two segments of our legs plus the palm of the foot. By animals that's also one long bone that's more or less vertical. So here you would take that part and you'd bend it up against the joint above it and you'd tie it. That's rogel. You can't do that on Shabbos, again, because that's more than you need in order to keep an animal from running away. The Mishnah goes on to say, so now the Mishnah describes another thing you can't have an animal go out with on Shabbos is with a ribbon or a strap tied between its horns. Where the idea is, it might be just for decoration, it might be that you'll tie a rope around that and you'll use that to lead the animal. Whatever the case, the Gemara discusses exactly what you might use such a ribbon for, but the point is that it's considered a burden on the animal. It's not something necessary. So the Mishnah mentions, Parosi, should Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, how you say Yotis, but it's Surah Shabin Karnel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's cow used to go out on Shabbos with a strap between its horns, Shaloi Birtsan Chachamim, which the Chachamim disapproved of. So the Gemara asks, What do you mean, the cow of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? Did he only have one cow? Rav himself said, or some say Rabbi Yehuda said in his name, Tracer Alfi Egli have him asked Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, may Edre call Shata Vashata. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would take as miser from his herd of animals every year 12,000 newborn calves. Now you only take miser from the newborn animals, the ones that were born that year. So that means every year he had 120,000 newborn calves, just calves of cattle in his herds, and of them he would take 12,000 as miser. So you see that he had a lot more than just one cow. So what are you saying, Parosa, as though he only had the one cow? Ion Yaakov points out, it's one thing, for example, a person himself might say one cow, like Yaakov says to Esav, but not when you're talking about somebody else. And also, also the Mishnah could have just said "Pora Sharab Alazman Azayu" or something. "Porosoi" suggests that it's the only cow he had. Tosfos, by the way, deals in some detail with the question: what kind of miser are we talking about over here? The question basically is that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was fairly young at the time of the Churban. We know from the story in Brachos that he was only 18 when he became Nasi, and that was some years after the Churban. So therefore, the minimum that he could have been at the maximum, really, that he could have been at the time of the Churban is 14 or 15 years old. So what do you mean, b'chol shat of a shat? What do you mean, every single year he was taking this many as Maaser? The Gemara explains in Bechoros that shortly after the Churban, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made a takana that you don't take Maaser Behema anymore. Because after all, Maaser Behema is supposed to be brought as a Churban, no Beis HaMikdash, no Korbanos. There's a problem of takola that people may end up using the animal for some other purpose and be committing Me'ilah. So what kol shata v'shata, how many times would he have had the opportunity from Bar Mitzvah until the Churban to be taking Maaser? So Tosfos gives a couple of possibilities. It could be that maybe it took some time before Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai made this gezeira. Maybe it could be that it means not Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah himself, but rather his apotropos. If we assume that his father passed away some years earlier and there was an apotropos managing the estate on his behalf when he's a katan, then the apotropos would be doing that for him. And a third possibility is maybe it doesn't mean miser as in miser behema, it means miser as in taxes for the king, where the government would also demand 10% of the newborn animals, and therefore that would be what he's doing. So the Tosfos in several other places in Shas brings these various answers, shlugs up some of them, accepts some of them, but whatever, those are the various possibilities. Anyway, so he had lots of cattle. So the answer is Tana. We learn in a Braisa, Loi Shaloi Hoisa. It wasn't actually his, El Shal Shente Hoisa. It actually belonged to a woman neighbor of his, or Mitoch Shaloi Michaba, but because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah didn't protest against it, Nikris Al Shmoi, it's called on his name as though he's the one, as though the cow belonged to him. There's someplace else, I think Yerushalmi actually, that says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah eventually regretted it, that he's going against the Chachamim and not protesting about it. And he fasted many fasts. Now, if it ever brings it in Perek Beis of the Geras HaTshuvah, he fasted so many fasts that his teeth turned black. Altadeva gives that as one of those examples where we find that the great Chachamim and Tzaddikim would fast many fasts, even for something which is not really objectively much of an Aveira at all. So now the Gemara is going to get into a whole discussion about this matter of being moicha in somebody else. Where now we're saying Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah failed to be moicha in his neighbor for what she was doing wrong, for what she was doing against the other Chachamim, and therefore he's blamed for it. So now we're going to have other examples of that. So the Gemara starts off. Rav v'Rab Chanina v'Rab Yochanan v'Rab Chaviva Masnu. These four Chachamim all learned the following. And the Gemara interjects before it says what they actually taught. Throughout Seder Moyed, whenever Kol Kihai Zuga, whenever you have these pairs of Chachamim, whenever it mentions Rav and Rav Chanina, who lived in Bavel, and Rav Yochanan and Rav Chaviva, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, so whenever it mentions them, there are those who take out Rav Yochanan and instead insert Rav Yonasan, that he would be the third one of the group. Whatever the case, they say, if somebody is able to protest against what people in his household are doing, and he doesn't, then he's blamed for what the people in his household are doing, because he could have prevented them, and therefore the averas that they do are held against him. Ion Yaakov points out, of course, the flip side of it is also true, mida tova meruba. So therefore, if he does protest and gets them to stop these things, then he gets a tremendous schar. There are halachas about it in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Yom HaKippurim. It talks about over there in connection with the dinim of Tosfos Yom HaKippurim, where we know this concept, you're supposed to start the fasting and the Isur Malacha of Yom Kippur a little bit early, but the Gemara mentions in Beitza that there were women who were careless about that because they didn't know that. And the Gemara talks about you don't necessarily tell them because you have multiv yoshoygin v'alyu mazidin. So you have those different cases. It depends whether we're dealing with an Isur Daraisa or Darabanan, or whether it's an Isur that's explicitly in the Torah versus only something that we learn from a drasha, or whether they're going to accept the machar or not. So there are various considerations. But the basic idea is when he could be moicha and he doesn't, then he's blamed for them. But anshe iro, if you have a person who's capable of being moicha on the people of a city, and and he doesn't, nitpasal anche iroi, then he's blamed for what everybody in his city does. Because again, he could have gotten them to do better. If he's somebody who has an effect on the, who has an influence on the whole world, Rashi gives an example. Let's say a king or a nasi, everybody's afraid of him, and everybody would listen to what he has to say. If he's not moicha, then he's held to account for what the entire world does. And the Gemara gives an example. Amar Papa, Vahani Debei Reish Galusa Nitpasim Al Kol Alma. For example, the members of the household of the Reish Galusa, they are the governors of, they were the governors of the Jewish people in Bavel at that point. So then everybody had tremendous derech eretz for them, or even if they didn't like them, they feared them at least because they had tremendous political power. So now if these members of the household of the Reish Galusa, if they're not moicha when they see people doing wrong, then that's an example of Nitpasim Al Kol Alma, where they're held to account for what the entire world does. Omar, okay, hold the Omar Rab Chanina. So we have in this connection what Rab Chanina says. The Girsa Omar would be that it's a new statement. Ki hod Omar would mean that what we're going to bring what Rab Chanina says as an illustration of what Rab Papa means. My dichtiv, what does it mean? A pasuk in Yeshaya. Hashem b'mishpat yovoy im ziknei ama v'sorav. Hashem will come in judgment. And the word mishpat, Rashi mentions in a number of places, has three different meanings. It can mean the judgment, as in the arguments, counter arguments. It can mean the verdict, and it can mean the punishment. So here it means the stage of the judgment, where the arguments are going back and forth. So Hashem will come in judgment im ziknei amei v'sarav against the elders of his people and their princes. So you have to ask, im sorim chotu zkeinim machotu, granted the sorim may have done averus. We find in many places in Tanakh where the sorim, the noblemen, the ministers or whatever, sometimes were corrupt and did averus. Zkeinim machotu, what did the zkeinim, which means the Sanhedrin, what did they do wrong? Now, Marsha points out that you sometimes do have. I mean, the chachamim of the Sanhedrin can also do wrong, unfortunately. But the point is that here, since the earlier psukim in Yeshaya, this is from Yeshaya Perek Gimel, earlier in Perek Aleph, which we read for the Haftarah with our Shabbos Chazon, you have the line over there, Sarayich Sardim, that your princes, your noblemen, are stubborn and they're taking bribes and whatnot. And there it doesn't say anything about the Zkeinim. So therefore, we should assume that this in Perek Gimel, where Yeshaya is continuing on that theme, that he means to only accuse the Sarim of doing wrong, not the Zkeinim. So the question is, why is Hashem going to come in judgment and with judgment and verdict and whatever against the Skenim when they didn't do anything wrong? The Rif also makes a point that because it says Ziknei Amoy Vasarov, if it meant that the Skenim had also done badly, then it would have phrased it a little bit differently. It would have said Ziknei Vasarov Amoy, for example. When it says Ziknei Amoy Vasarov, it suggests that the Skenim and the Sarim are two completely separate groups. One is doing Averus and the other one is not. So the answer is Ela Ema Al Skenim Shalem Michu Vasarim. The point is that Hashem is holding the Skenim responsible because they didn't protest against the Sarim. Given that they are the members of the Sanhedrin and the Sodom would have paid attention to what they say, then therefore, if they don't, then they're held responsible. Another example of this kind of thing, of being moicha when you see that somebody is doing wrong, Rabbi Yehuda have a Yosef Kameh de Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda was sitting as a Talmud in front of Shmuel. Asoi hahi itza kotsavchus kameh. A certain woman came and was crying out in front of Shmuel about some injustice, about something where she needed Shmuel to take care of the situation. Well, I have a mashkochba, but he wasn't paying any attention to her. Omalei, so Rabbi Yehuda tells him, loy sovalei mar, Rebbe, don't you hold of what it says in the pasuk? The pasuk says that if a person closes up his ear against the screams of the poor, gamhu yikra v'lo ye'one, he also will call out to Hashem, and Hashem won't answer him. Mida k'neged mida. So why are you ignoring this lady? Marsha says, by the way, that what do you mean? What do you mean? Loy sovalei mar. Shmuel knows of the pasuk. Of course, he knows. Of course, he accepts the pasuk. The expression should be, what doesn't it say in the pasuk, such and such. So Marsha explains, because you could, on the simple level of the pasuk, you would explain that it means when a person closes his ears, when a person is asking for this, pleading for tzedakah, and you ignore it. But so therefore, Rav Yehuda is telling him, but don't you also consider that the pasuk may also be referring to a dayan like you who is ignoring when someone poor is coming and then crying for justice? Amalei. So Shmuel answers him, Shinana. He says, sharp one, which that was Shmuel's favorite nickname for him, referred of Yoda, all over Shas. Reshach b'krivi, your head, meaning I, your Rebbe, may be only in cold water over this. Reshach b'reshach b'chamim. But the head of your head, meaning there's somebody over me, there's somebody higher in rank than me, he's going to be in hot water for this. Marsha points out the pasuk over there that says the pasuk that he's going to quote, Dinu Laburka Mishpat, because Hashem continues that otherwise my anger will burn like a fire. So therefore Shmuel uses the metaphor of being scalded with hot water. So the superior of your superior, meaning somebody higher than me, is the one who's going to be scalded with hot water. Ha-yosef ma'ukva, Av Beis Din, and after all, ma'ukva, the Av Beis Din is sitting, and this is his department, not mine. Dichtiv, and in fact, the pasuk says, Beis David koyamar Hashem. Hashem says to the house of David, Dinu laboka mishpat, judge justice in the morning, and save the people who are being wronged from the people who are wronging them. So we see, in other words, that the pasuk is threatening punishment only for the one whose job it is whose bailiwick it is to be judging. So since this is Ma'ukva's area and he's the Abbasid, then don't come to me saying that I should be paying attention to this woman. Instead, go to Ma'ukva and tell him. On the other hand, though, so that was Shmuel's point. On the other hand, though, it's an interesting thing. There's a Gemara in a couple of places in Shas, in Psachim and in Bava Basra, where it tells a story where Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's son one time was very near death. They thought his neshama had already left his body. Eventually he revived and recovered, and they asked him, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi asked him, what'd you see when your neshama was lamayla? So he says, Olam hafuch ra'isi, I saw an upside down world. The people who are above here in Olam Hazeh are down below in Olam Haba and vice versa. And Rabbi Shoban Levi tells him, actually, Olam boru ra'isa, what you saw is the correct way of the world. Here in this world, we often think there are people who are greater than they really are. And in the Olam Emes, we find out the truth. So there's an interesting thing that the Gaonim bring, that one of the things that the son of Yosef, the son of Rabbi Shoban Levi, saw in Shemayim, he saw that Shmuel is sitting as a Talmud in front of Rabbi Hoda. Now, in our world, Shmuel was the Rebbe and Rabbi Yehuda was the Talmud. But because of this Gemara, because Rabbi Yehuda took it on himself to challenge Shmuel that he should be doing something about this, so Shmuel is brushing him off and telling him that, no, it's Ma'ukva's department. But nevertheless, because Rabbi Yehuda took it in his hand to actually call out Shmuel on it, therefore he has the schus in the Olam HaEmes that he is Shmuel's Rebbe rather than the other way around. The Gemara continues, Amalei Rab Zeira Rab Simon, Lechichinu Ma'al Lahani De Beiresh Kabusa. You, Rab Simon, should be giving Musar to the people of the household of the Resh Kabusa. Like we said, the Resh Kabusa was the governor of the Jews in Babel. He had tremendous, he and his household and all of his attendants and whatever had tremendous power. And we find in a number of places in Shas where unfortunately sometimes they were also corrupt or at least not behaving the way they should. So Reb Zera says to Reb Shimon, you should be telling them off for it. Amalei, so Reb Shimon says, not going to work. Lemakabli minoi, they're not going to listen to me. And here's where Tosfos says that it's a suffix whether they're going to listen to him or not. Where you know for a fact that they're not going to listen, then we have, like we said before, mutavir shogin value mazidin, when it's not something that's clearly daraisa and so forth. You have different details about that in Shulchan Aruch. Anyway. So Reb Simon says, it's not going to do any good. They're not going to listen to me anyway. Omalei, but Reb Zera says, Afagav Dolei Mekabli, even though they're not, you may think they may not accept it from you, Lechachinu Ma'ar. Nevertheless, you should be giving them Musar, and maybe they will listen. And if not, then you're going to be held responsible, like we said before in the Gemara. And here, the Gemara is going to give a long drasha that this point is going to emerge from that. That when a tzaddik has the ability to tell off a rasha, and it might get him to change his ways, then if he doesn't, then he's held responsible. What happened? The Amar of Acha Berav Chanina, Me'olam lo yotza midah tova m'piyah kodesh baruch v'chozib ala ra. It never happened that a midah tova came out from Hashem's mouth, that Hashem made a promise for good and then changed his mind for bad, chutz mi davar zeh, with one exception about the tzaddikim being punished at the time of Churban Bayis Rishon. Moshe refers to what he says in Brachos, that there's a difference when you have, when Hashem is not explicitly promised, or at least when there hasn't been a public nevuah about it. For example, we do have the concept, Shema Yigram Achet. After all, Yaakov, for example, is nervous that his Averis might cause that the promises that Hashem gave to him won't be fulfilled. But there was promises to an individual, it's not to the Tzibur, etc. Anyway, here, so this was the one exception. So you have like this. The Pasuk says in Yechezkel, "Vayomer Hashem Eimav." Hashem says to him, to a malach that Hashem was sending, "Aver b'socha ir b'socha Yerushalayim, pass around through the city of Yerushalayim, v'hisvisa tov, and you should make a mark." Literally, the word tov means a mark. The Gemara is going to explain later on. We'll get to it tomorrow, Bez Hashem, that it actually means a letter tov. So make a mark al mitzchos hanoshim hanenochim vanenochim on the foreheads of the people who are groaning and krechting and sighing al kolat ha'eves hanasas about all the disgusting things that are being done in Yerushalayim. Meaning, in other words, you're talking about the tzaddikim. They're krechting and moaning and groaning over all the bad things that are being done in Yerushalayim. So therefore, put a tuff on their forehead as a mark that when the other malachim of destruction come, as the Gemara is going to explain further on, to destroy and kill the people of Yerushalayim, they'll spare them because they were the tzaddikim and they had nothing to do with the Averis. So that means the Gemara teaches out. Omalei Hakadosh Baruch Hu LeGavriel, Leich Urashem Al Mitzchan Chal Tzaddikim Tuf Shal Diyoy. Go mark on the foreheads of the tzaddikim a tuff of ink. We're talking about Pashto as a ruchniistic mark. We're not saying people would walk around there and see tufts on each other's foreheads. But the ruchniist put a tuff of ink. Shalo yishlukim behem malachah chabala. It'll be a sign that the malachim of destruction who are going to be sent throughout Yerushalayim will not have any power over them. And also mark the foreheads of the Rishoyim with a tuff of blood. That will be a signal to the Malachi Chabala that they should dominate them and they should kill them. In other words, what's going to happen basically is these Malachim are going to kill them, Beruchnius, and then that'll make it possible for Nebuchadnezzar and his army to go and kill them, Begashnius. Now Tosfos says the Pasuk is not clearly saying that there was any mark on the foreheads of the Rishoyim. We said Hanenochim Banenochim, which Rashi says refers to the Tzaddikim. Where do we see anything about a mark on the foreheads of the Rishoyim? Tosfos says the Svara that evidently there was, but Tosfos doesn't explain what the Svara was. Maoshor explains, because after all, besides Tzaddikim and Rishoyim, there's a Beinanim. So the Beinanim, they don't necessarily specifically deserve to be saved, but they don't specifically deserve to be destroyed either. So therefore, Hashem is telling the Malach, mark the tzaddikim gmurim with one mark the Rishoyim gmurim with another mark. The ones in between, leave them unmarked, and we'll deal with them, so to speak, on a case by case basis. Maosho also says that the word ne'enochim v'ne'enochim actually can refer to both the tzaddikim and the Rishoyim. Ne'enochim would refer to the tzaddikim, that they're krechting and groaning over the terrible averus that are being done, and they can't do anything about it. Ne'enochim is a loshen and a pasuk that refers to the kind of groaning when a person is killed and they let out like one last groan and then they're quiet. Then that's when a person is killed, that would describe the Rishoyim who are actually going to be killed. So the word Nanochim and Nanochim can actually refer to both the Tzaddikim and the Rishoyim. Anyway, so Hashem is telling the Malach to do that. But Omra Midas Adin Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Midas Adin says to Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Manishtanu Elu Me'elu, what's the difference between one group and another? You're saying there's Tzaddikim and there's Rishoyim, but after all, why should one group deserve to be saved more than the other? Which means Anaf Yosef explains, in other words, that what they mean is that that even these tzaddikim, you could argue that you're saying that you're going to save the tzaddikim. Is it just because compared to the Rishoyim, they appear as tzaddikim, but they're not necessarily so good in and of themselves? Or are you talking about that they're actually tzaddikim? Anyway, Omala, so Hashem says, what do you mean? How all the tzaddikim gmurim, how all the Rishoyim gmurim? But the Midas Adin says, after all, they could have protested against the Averis that the Rishoyim are doing, and they didn't. Allah, so Hashem says, what do you want from them? It's well known and revealed before me that if they had protested, the Rishoyim wouldn't listen. So therefore, it wouldn't have done any tzaddikim any good to protest anyway. But the Midas Adin says, it's certainly known to you. Was it revealed to them? They didn't know for sure. They should have at least made the attempt. And if they didn't, then you shouldn't be giving them this special protection. V'hainu d'chtiv, and thus we have that, so to speak, Hashem changed his mind and accepted the Midas Adin's argument. So the pasuk continues that, and this is Yechezkel was describing how he saw all of this in a vision of Nevuah. Hashem tells the Malach, Zokin Bochur of Sula, the Taf Benosh and Taugel Mashkas, the elders, the young men, the young women, the children, the women, kill them and destroy them. Va'okol Ish Asher Olavat Tov Al Tigashu. Don't come close to any of the people who have a Tov on their forehead. So far, this is Hashem saying, in other words, the Tzaddikim should be immune. But then it continues, Umimik Doshi Tochelu. Then the Pasuk continues, and start from my Mikdash. Now, Pasuk of Pshat, it means start with the people who are doing Averis right there in the Bis Mikdash. But the pasuk continues, "Vayochelu ba'anoshim azkenim asher lifnei haboyis." They began with the elders, who, meaning the, as we said before, the skenim, meaning the members of the Sanhedrin, who are in front of the Beis Mikdash. So, and Tony Rabbi Yosef, "Al tukri mimikdoshi elam mimikudoshai." Don't read the word mimikdoshi from my Beis Mikdash, but rather mimikudoshai from my holy ones. Meaning, in other words, that Hashem is, so to speak, changing his mind and saying that start with the ones who are holy. Elu b'nei Adam shekimu as haTorah kula me'alef bad tof. So the people who kept the entire Torah from Aleph to Tof, they're definitely tzaddikim, but and they are mimikudoshai, and they're lifnei habois. Marsha explains it means they're the members of the Sanhedrin who actually sit in the lushkas hagazis, which is in front of the Beis Mikdash, and Hashem is, so to speak, changing his mind and accepting the argument of the Midas Hadin that as much as they were tzaddikim, they failed to be moicha on the people, and they didn't know, they should have given it the attempt, not knowing whether the people are going to listen, and therefore they're going to be the first ones marked to be destroyed by the malachim. So therefore, so Reb Zera says to Reb Simon, so you see from that, the same thing with the members of the Reish Kolos's household, you may think they're not going to listen to you, but you won't know unless you try. And if you don't try, then you're going to be in the same situation as those escape. So Umiyad, so right away, the pasuk continues. Now the next pasuk the Gemara is going to quote is actually earlier. The next pasuk the Gemara is going to quote is at the beginning of Perek Tes, the psukim that we had before, Avor B'Sar Chayir, are further on in the Perek. Marsha explains what it means is, that Hashem is saying right at the beginning of the Perek that there are six malachim all ready to carry out the sentence. As soon as Hashem decides who is going to be the ones who are going to be sentenced, and then you have the continuation in the psukim over there where Hashem is first telling Gavriel to mark the people with the respective marks. So the pasuk says, "V'hinei shisha anoshim boin miderech shara elyon Hashem mofnet zafon." Now, six men, malachim, are coming from the way of the upper gate, which faces towards the north. This is one of the north. This is one of the northwestern gate of the Har HaBayis. In later times, it was called Shara Yechonia. It was also called Shara Elyon. Anyway, v'ish klima potze v'yodeh. The pasuk continues. Each one had his weapon of destruction in his hand. Klima potze literally means a weapon of shattering, like a hammer or something. V'ish echad b'seichem levush habadim. There's one man among them who is dressed in linen, which is Gavriel, which is Malach Gavriel. V'kes is a sofer b'masnav, and there's a tablet of a sofer around his waist, meaning kabyachol, like he's going to be the one recording and writing down the names of who's to be spared and who's not. And they came and stood next to the Mizbeach HaNechoshes, and then Hashem gave them their instructions. The Gemara says, "What Mizbeach HaNechoshes? Mizbeach HaNechoshes, mihava? What Mizbeach HaNechoshes?" We're talking about Yechezkel's times, the end of the first Beis Mikdash, when the first Beis Mikdash was built already. Shlomo had put away the Mizbeach HaNechoshes along with most, if not all, the other Kalim of the Mishkan, and instead he built a Mizbeach of stones, a permanent Mizbeach. So what Mizbeach HaNechoshes? So the answer is, Amar Elohu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Haschilu Mimakim Sha'umim Shira Lefanai, means he's telling the Malachim, start from the place where they say Shira before me, where Levim sing, and the instruments that they use, some of them at least are made out of copper. For example, the Gemara in Erchin, for example, mentions a pair of cymbals that they had that were made out of copper, and there were other musical instruments because copper is very resonant and it makes good instruments. So the point is, Mizbeach HaNechoshes means the Mizbeach where they played with near which they played music using instruments made out of copper or made out of bronze. Marshall refers to, Tosfos asks that you have other psukim also that refer to the Mizbeach HaNechoshes, and you could say the same thing. It means that they played the instruments over there. Moshe says, okay, in other places you could say that no, it means the Mizbeach that's substituting for the Mizbeach and the Choshes. But here there's no need to mention it at all. Therefore, the Gemara is doubting that it means that he's telling the Malachim to start with the Levium who play the instruments. And then we'll continue with the rest of the story and doubting it tomorrow, Bez Hashem. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola, Dalad Nissen. Beruchnius, up to the highest levels, we already have, that I've talked about in Tovshin and Beis, we already have the complete Inyonim up to the Shlemus of the Geula Beruchnius. So therefore said, the spiritual eyes of Bnei Yisrael already see the Geula. Now we just need to open our physical eyes and also see the Geula the way it is, the Geula, that it should be real, that it should be realized by physical eyes nowadays as well. Continuing on halachas as far as brachas on fragrances, so we talked about the various sources that a fragrance might come from: a fruit, a tree, an herb, a non-semeach kind of thing, and then the special one for Shemana Farisimon. So now, if you have something that's supposed to be Bode Atze B'Samim, and instead you say on it Bode Isve B'Samim or vice versa, then you're not Yotze. But if you say Bode Min HaBesamim on anything, you Yotze. So therefore, anything that you have a suffix on, then you say on it Bode Min HaBesamim. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch continues to say that if you were to make the same thing on a fruit, for example, we said before in Esther, you're supposed to say Hanoisin Reach Tov HaPeres. He says that if you were to say Bode Atze B'Samim, you'd be Yotze. Although Rabbi Bistritzky adds that from the Alter Rebbe's Lashon is Mashma that he wouldn't be Yotze. Therefore, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch continues that for cloves, you would say Bode Atze B'Samim. And also for orange peels or lemon peels, you would also say Bode Atze B'Samim, because they are, after all, the product of a tree and they're not the fruit. According to the Alter Rebbe, because cloves are a suffix, then instead you would say on them Bode Min HaBesamim.